Hi, I'm Rob Nesbitt, and this is the ProCartoon.com podcast. I look at the tools of the trade, tips, tricks, podcast reviews and interviews, and more to help you in your cartooning and artistic work. In this episode of the podcast, I talk to professional cartoonist Perry Taylor. Perry, originally from Oxford, England, has lived in Gascony, France since 2004, and unlike many expats, has absolutely immersed himself into the quirks of French life. His fame has grown to such an extent that the tourist board have thanked him for doing a better job at promoting the Gascony region through his candid cartoons of local life than they have. He has studied local architecture, traditions, customs, food and drink, and a way of life in this beautiful corner of France that is reminiscent of rose-bespectacled summers from years gone by. Perry masterfully reflects this wonderful tranquil lifestyle in pen and ink and astounds the local folk with vibrant colours packed with detail as they dissect the Gascony psyche with warmth and lashings of wit. It was through my father, who lives much further north in the Burgundy region, that I got to hear of Perry's French adventure. After visiting his website and reading Perry's Voyage from the Cotswolds all the way to a stunning house in the south of France, I knew I had to feature him on this podcast. He accepted my invitation and was kind enough to send me a copy of his latest compilation of cartoons. I was simply blown away by the artistic skill and great sense of humour that radiated off every page. You can see the show notes and the transcription of the podcast at ProCartoon.com on the podcast page. Okay, let's dive straight into the podcast. Hi, Perry, and welcome to the Pro Cartoon Podcast.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for inviting me.
When did your cartooning career begin, and what was the influence that made you start drawing?
I suppose I always did cartoons as a kid, and I was cartooning also my colleagues, my tutors and stuff like this. I thought that was a crazy world. The advertising world that I entered into was even crazier, and you know, characters were often larger than life. So I would cartoon them mostly because of the injustices of being a creative person in an advertising world, where you come up with a great idea, a great campaign, and then they go off, and between them and the account person from the client, they change the headline, they change the concept and come back. And so, you know, you would just being used and abused. So I'd often do cartoons about what we call the bag carriers.
Right. Are there other artistic members or ancestors in your family?
Well, apart from my grandfather, who really guided me a lot, we come from, a long way back. We're from the Hathaway family. We were the Hathaway Taylors up until, I think, probably three generations ago, and they dropped the Hathaway. But Hathaway Taylors, Anne Hathaway, was my great-great-great-great-great, I think it's nine greats, grandmother. And as you may or may not know, she was married to some bloke who was pretty good at drawing plays and lived in Stratford-upon-Avon. And Anne Hathaway's cottage was our, I suppose, the family home until, well, quite some time, I think 1850, something like that, in the 40s. That's when it was finally given over to the National Trust, I think, and then I think the William Shakespeare Society. I can't remember who runs it now. But I was there a little while back, and even though, you know, being supposedly part of the family, you still have to pay your shilling to get in and see.
Yeah, I've been there myself, so I have visited Perry's ancestral home. Did you follow an art-based academic life back in England?
Yeah, I did. So since I was always drawing, I did my O-level art, A-level art, did really well in that. And I had a great art teacher, Andy Crisp, if you're out there. He was a fantastic calligrapher. He'd also used to say, Taylor, I'm the one that tells the jokes around here, because I was always the comedian at the back. Or in art class, I was always at the front, I have to say. So from there, I went on, did foundation course in Banbury, which is just north of Oxford. And that was for a year. And then I went on to London to what was Hornsey School of Art, which became part of Middlesex Polytechnic. And that was a four-year course, which is graphic design, information communication art, and scientific and technical illustration, which was, you know, a little bit too finickety for me. All the girls seemed to be drawing the bugs and the flowers and the leaves, and all us guys did all the technical stuff, which is, you know, doing an exploded three-dimensional view of plane engines and stuff like that. That was a lot more fun.
Are you a full-time cartoonist? And if so, when did this happen, and what tipped the decision?
Obviously, I've been through, had a creative life working as a graphic designer, then as a creative person, art director, and then creative director for advertising agencies. We just eventually decided, my wife is Dutch, I lived in Amsterdam at that time, we had enough, we wanted to do something else. And I had a bit of a burnout, to be honest, running my own agency, and I spent 2 years in meetings. I never touched a magic marker in that time. And it was very frustrating seeing all the creative guys we had there having fun and me going into another new business meeting. So after 4 years of that, I said to my partners, I'm out of here. And we came to France, and I picked up an ink pen, which I hadn't touched since I was at art college, and started doing some little doodles of the local villages and local people. And one of my influences is Sampé. I don't know if you know the Jean-Jacques Sampé. He did hundreds of covers for the New Yorker. And I love the fact that he can do a drawing in black and white, and it's just a little old lady in a field, and there's something going on. There are lots of little details. You don't need text. And it's one of those exasperating little moments in one's lives when one has to make a decision or is confronted with things. It's just so simple, and I love it. It has a warmth to it. It gives us a warm smile, and there's humanity in it. And I felt that's the way I was, the way I felt. And I started drawing the locals from there, and these little elements, the little characters, came out. And once I did one for our family live in the same village, and they invited us to come and pick grapes. And we were four generations. So it was the grandma and the grandfather falling asleep, and they were looking after the baby. The rest of us were there with big buckets going up and down, and lots of conversation, funny things happening in between, you know, bottles of beer at the end of each row. And it was a great day. And then at the end, we then gathered under the tree. There was this huge table full of the hams and the jambons and the pâtés and the foie gras from their own animals. And as a thank you, I drew this cartoon, which is basically the vines with all the different things I'd seen that day. And I gave it to them as a present, saying, just, I had a wonderful experience. And they said, well, this is amazing. And then they called me back a couple of days later, said, could we have a couple of copies? Because all the family want to have one. So I started making copies, and I just thought about it. Carol said, you're on a winner here. I said, yeah. So I started doing stuff. And then I did some really nice, beautiful medieval villages that we have here with a little bit of shenanigans going on in the front and left, you know, little old pappy going by in his slippers and his cycle. I mean, you could walk faster than him, you know, with his baguette strapped in on the back and all sorts of stuff. And that's how it grew. And after still working as a graphic designer and illustrating, I was getting hassled and frustrated by having to reach, you know, change things for the client and think, oh, it can't be billed. And then here we go again. So Caroline said, you know what? I think you can make a great living if we really put our minds to it, both of us together. And that's what we did 8 years ago now. We did that, and we never looked back.
That's brilliant. You've had an interesting career as a graphic designer and advertising art director working in London and Amsterdam. Could you describe what the work entailed and some memorable projects that you worked on?
When I started as a graphic designer, you didn't have computers. They were really just something that the typesetter had. You know, you'd have a sheet of text, it was A4 text, and then you'd count off the letters. And then from there, with a slide rule, you could work out the size of the type, the leading in between each line, and the width. And that would then go off to the typesetter. They type it out. It would then be brought back on a sheet of bromide paper. And then we put it through a wax machine, slice it, and put it onto, we had like an architect has the tables with the horizontals, stick that down. And then, of course, there would be the corrections. So you then have a 10A blade scalpel and slice between the lines and change things around and set all that up. And that would all be blue lined baseboards, because they would not be seen by the cameras. And there would be your trims and your gutters and things like this. So those are, the most technological thing we had at that time was a photocopier that did A3 or A4 or a couple of percentages left and right. So we used to play around with those, and a grand projector, which is one of the things where you stuck your head in with the two huge lamps underneath, and you ball your head while you were then tracing over tracing paper to get it to another size. I mean, nowadays people say, what? You know, typesetters are gone. The typographers, the fantastic typographers with their art, were all just became dinosaurs overnight when the Mac arrived. You know, but no, graphic design was very much that, and that was working logos. I did posters for the National Theatre, for the Royal Festival Ballet, and also for some West End theatre. I also did labels for wine, champagne, Melita coffee. Crikey, this stuff of white coal tar soaps, if you remember. Oh, and also some record sleeves for Flock of Seagulls. Remember them?
Yeah.
Seagulls were in, what was that, Zomba Records. And then I moved across into the advertising side. I was just more interested in more of the concept, because I thought you could have, I love word plays and concepts. And so I got myself into an agency, a recruitment agency, first of all, and then moved into retail and then full-time advertising. And that was great, working on campaigns for Grolsch beer, and then later moving to Amsterdam, had the opportunity. Is that Nissan Europe had just moved into the European headquarters in Amsterdam, and our sister agency in Amsterdam had won the account, but unfortunately had no one that worked on cars. So they contacted our agency and said, "Are any of your guys, worked on cars before?" I stuck my hand out and said, "Oh, absolutely, stuff in BFW." The only thing I'd ever done was a lottery prize for a pharmaceutical client we worked for was a BMW. So I'd actually drawn BMW and put it into this ad. But they said, "Great, great, great." I was on the plane 2 days later, met an American copywriter. It was an international team, Japanese, German, American, God knows who was there. And we did this whole campaign to launch the Micra, as it was then. And I was supposed to be there for a week to help. And after 2 days, they said, "Would you like a contract?" So I said, "Yeah, absolutely." So I got an 18-month contract and ended up being there for 14 years.
What is your process when a client commissions you for cartoons?
That depends. I think when I first started doing it, I would take on everything that they would give to me and all the elements, and it would become a mishmash of, the brother, the sister, the dog, the house, and we've got to have this hobby in and her horse. And it almost looked like I'd sort of photoshopped some 20 different elements into a drawing. It didn't always work for me, but I think I've become some stronger and more confident in myself over time, is that now I dictate what I think should work. And I said, if you want a Perry, then it will be a Perry. Give me a few of your thoughts about what you're looking for. And then, as we say, give me the freedom of a tight brief. But don't nail me down to the point that I've got to have all these elements in. So generally, I try and say, I want to keep my character in the drawings that I'm creating. I want it to be my idea based on my observation from you. And generally, they said, "That's great." I've just done a huge wine map of part of Southwest France. And I think there are, seven or eight different sort of regions and growers around here. And they said, we want you to do the map. So long as you just keep the roads and the chateaus and the domains in place, you have carte blanche, which is great. So in every field, lane, and village square, there's something going on. There's someone playing ball. There's a fisherman. There's a hunter. There's someone having a pee behind a tree. There's a couple of old guys playing ball. There's people hunting, mushrooms, and they're picking grapes and all sorts of little things happening. And, you've got ducks and geese and all sorts of characters, all doing naughty things as well. You have to really look well. But that's now on this big map that I've got a typographer who's put all the text in all around it, so it works for the tourists. But that was good fun, because they gave me the freedom to be myself and not feel hampered.
In the early days, I was trying to do everything that they wanted, but you can't, and it just spoils it then for yourself. Your artistic flair sort of goes out the window. So did you ever have a client from hell? Perhaps you had many.
Yes. I worked with a Japanese agency for 2 years, Asatsu, and they had their team that had come in from Japan, and we were working on Mitsubishi Europe, the cars. And that was really difficult, because the client didn't speak any English, and that was supposedly working language. I was dealing with the Dutch, who are very blunt, straightforward, and get to the point, whereas the Japanese are, more evasive than the English are. We'll talk around. It's what we say or what we don't say is what we mean, if you know what I mean. we don't say what we mean. And they're 3 degrees even further. So you have the two worlds apart from, the Japanese account man saying yes, and then the Dutch guy, yes. And I said, no, that doesn't mean yes. It just means yes, he's politely saying he understands. He's now going to take this back 2-3 levels up, and then this will be seen by the president in the end. It will come back down. It will be nothing like what you've just said, you think he's just said yes to, believe me. And so I used to work as a mediator between the Dutch who were frustrated and the Japanese who were affronted and, you know, not wanting to lose face. I was there, I was the creative coordinator for Spain, France, Germany, England, and Holland. Bloody nightmare. And again, I bought my flat in that time, and I thought, you know what, I really don't care. I spent a lot of the time working on projects, and I had the creative teams go out and doing stuff, but I just worked on my flat, and when it came to the end of the two-year contract, I went freelance. But that's it. No more.
I don't blame you. Sounds horrific. You moved to France in 2004, and you bought a house in, forgive my pronunciation,
Haute-Pyrénées.
Yeah.
Which means the High Pyrenees. It's not actually the highest point, it's just it's the middle of the Pyrenees. On the west coast, you have Pyrénées Atlantiques, that's where Bayonne and Biarritz, that side. And then you have the Pyrénées Orientales, which is where you've got Perpignan, just north of Barcelona, that side. But we're in the middle, and that's the Haute Pyrénées, the High Pyrenees.
I'm glad you said it for me. You've already intimated why you went to France, but why did you relocate, and how have you found life in France?
I think it was a life changing event. Absolutely. I thought that Amsterdam was the best place in the world. And, you know, having lived there for 14 years, I just loved it. You know, you get on the bike, you cycle through to all the cafes, over the canals, you could be in the countryside in 10 minutes. It was becoming a little less tolerant than it was when I was first there in the beginning of the 90s. People would get a little bit more uptight, and also the more and more tourists. And it always was a beautiful cosmopolitan village. That was what I loved about it. You know, you take 25 minutes to get from one side to the other on a bike. To a certain extent, I needed to get away from that simply because of what was going on with my company. So when we were looking, Caroline spoke pretty good French. My French wasn't too bad. And so having worked down in southeast of France, in the Côte d'Azur, I did lots of photo shoots and film shoots for car clients that I work with. I work with Daewoo and Opel and Nissan, as I said, and a little bit Renault. And so they have all the model agencies down there, production agencies. They have the studios. So you go to Antibes, and they've got the big big harbour wall there where Mercedes and everyone's fighting to get there for that beautiful light coming off the water. So I was doing loads of shoots down there, and I loved it. But of course, I wasn't paying the bills, so the agency was paying for the bills. So we went down there on our honeymoon. We thought, I'm have a look at this. It could be great, you know. It was expensive, and we looked at the properties, and it was just crazy. And there was a certain, I don't know, hardness to the people. I think because they've been invaded by, you know, the rich and the wealthy, and, you know, you've got the Russians coming down and the Arabs coming down and the well-to-do Brits, I say, all coming down and their stuff. And they're all into these sort of fenced communities, a little like when I was working in South Africa a couple of times. And, you know, everything was fenced off with alarm to think, well, that's your little paradise, but it isn't really great. We then went across to look more to the west, where an old colleague of Caroline had great French. She said, if you're going down that way, go and have a look. So we took a flight to Bordeaux, jumped in the car. And as we came to a place called Condom, don't laugh, Condom, I just saw this beautiful landscape, which for me was, it was like the Cotswolds, but you had this sort of, all the pillowcases of the Pyrenees in the background and the cypress trees. And for me at that time, I didn't realize that it had been said before, but I said, this is like a Tuscan Cotswolds. It was beautiful. And what I loved about it is that everything seemed untouched. There was no big industry. There wasn't really anything, you know, the big cities were fine, but it was mostly villages. It was agriculture. But these beautiful medieval villages, it was like, as a lot of people say, the time stopped still in the 1950s, 1960s. Puppies here still drive around. Still got the berets. They still drive around in, you know, Renault 4s and Deschevaux and 404s and Seicans, C15 Citroën vans. And, you know, that's the way it is. The market's exactly the same. People are doing the same thing. It's thinking, well, you know, this could have been, you know, from a Jacques Tati film, who was also one of my great heroes. And we just found the peace, and we just loved it. This was, I think we both needed that. And so we started looking, and we went down five or six times and thought, okay, the prices are sort of all right. I know that we'll find something here that we like. So when we came back, I just had a discussion with my partners, and I thought, well, I won't say what I thought. It begins with an F. And I said, so
France.
Right. Yeah, yes. So that's it. I went back. I said, when we go back, I'm resigning. I'm stepping out, and we're going to start a new life. And Caroline just was so pleased. She'd been waiting to get away forever. And so that was it. I went back to my partner and said, we're gone. So we put the flat on the market. It was sold within a month, amazingly. Everything into storage, cats in a home for a couple of weeks. And then that was it. We went down with the car. I bought a trailer big old trailer, learned how to reverse it twice round the corner, and I thought, okay, that's fine. Filled it, that was 2 days before we left, filled it with, you know, half a dozen suitcases and toolkits and two bikes, and off we went. And we'd hired this little hunting pavilion, which is about, you know, 7 by 7 meters. It was a hexagon, 4 meters high, so you couldn't heat it. It was ridiculously high. That's like 16 feet or 15 feet of them. And that was it for 14 months. We then looked around every day in the car and finally found something that wasn't on the market at all. And this little old lady, that Caroline, she's the Dutch lady, you know, she does the negotiating. I'm a softie on that level. That was it. We negotiated our way with her over a period of 3 months. And then 3 months later, we got the key and we moved in. It's a beautiful old farmhouse. It's a 250-year-old farmhouse with lots of what we call the colombage, you know, the wood frames. And it's probably almost a meter thick walls downstairs, so it's beautifully cool in the summer and nice and warm in the winter. But we've done a lot with it, loads of stuff, but it's changed my life really, because moving here again, starting to draw again, I've now changed my career completely, and I'm a little bit of a sort of quite well known here. I'm known as an ambassador for the Gers by the tourist office. The president of the Department of Gers came up and shook my hand the other day. Actually, he shook elbows because we were still in confinement. And he said, "I want to thank you because you are, you know, you're doing a better job than we are at advertising."
Your cartoons typify French life beautifully. What do your French friends think of your artwork?
Generally, they're astonished that someone from outside can portray them in such a way. They said, "How do you know this?" And I said, "Well, I watch and I ask." And I love talking to the older generation because they have all the anecdotes of how it was before. And I think there's a certain, I don't know, a warmth, serendipity. There's a feeling of comfort when you think of, when we think of, you know, happy days in our grandma's garden, of, you know, eating strawberries with granddad here. And I think you, as children, we had that sort of comfort zone. And summers were always warmer and longer, and we could put our feet in the streams, and we could do all sorts of fun stuff as kids. And, you know, nowadays you're frightened to even have the kid, your child, you know, 10 yards away from you on the street. You know, it's a different world. And I think that is very important, the genre that I've picked upon, because it touches me as well. But no, they're astounded. I do lots of stuff about, you know, the hunt or the vineyards or the market. I just go to the market and watch and chat with people. And I just follow the gestures and how they stand and what they do. Then I hear these words and phrases, and I love wordplays. So I do a lot of French wordplays, which they think, "Well, how does that work? I mean, you're not even French, and you're doing French wordplays, and we haven't even thought of that one." You know, I've always done wordplays in English and in Dutch as well. So that was great. And so yes, I'm being commissioned all the time to do stuff because you're the go-to man. I'm now doing bag-in-box wine, bag-in-box wines with top wine houses here with illustrations, my style of illustrations. Say, "We give you carte blanche. This is what we're looking for. We want that Perry feel to the life here in the Gers." And I've even had, quite a few times, people come up to me, a French person, and say, "I've been looking for you. I had a Perry moment yesterday." And then they start explaining about something they'd seen. They said, "Oh, that was just like one of your cartoons." I said, "Well, yes." It's an observation. It's obviously not a straight-on observation, but it's quirky things, putting things together. Like we have these, what they call a mirador, and these are these little podiums where the hunters stand up. It's like 2-3 steps up, so they're higher, and then they can see further. They can see the wild boar coming. Also, because, you know, often the hunters are not that accurate, it's good that you're above and shooting down. Because if you're shooting, you know, horizontally, those things go for about 2 miles. And, there have been incidents. But so I've done this drawing of wild boar on top of this mirador, where he's got his hand over his eyes, you know, looking into the distance. And all the other wild boar are going, "And? Can we go?" And the hunters, they just love it. They say, "Well, how do you think of this stuff?" You know, I'll tell you one other, if I may. We have the palombe here, which is the wood pigeon that we know only too well. But they come through in huge flocks for migration. They go down in October and they come back in February down to Spain. And they settle all these hides. And normally they're up in the trees or they're flat and they're all covered in camouflage. And these guys on the hunt, they go for about 2 weeks and that's it. That's all different. And so I got this drawing of this hunter there, and he's got boxes and bags full of wine, aperitif, he's got the whiskey, he's got the vica, he's got the bread, he's got the canard, he's got the cheese, he's got everything he's required. And then he looks down and says, I forgot my wife. Most of the hunters' wives say, it's that, it's exactly that. You know, he spends 2 days prepping all this stuff. And it has, this came from a story where six hunters had been up there, all gone up there, and they sat down, had the aperitif, had breakfast, and then realized that no one had brought any cartridges. So they had nothing to fire. So so the pigeons had an easy day, and they all got rattles.
That's brilliant. Brilliant. I think I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Would you ever go back to England?
I'd never go back to England, certainly not now. And apart from that, if I was, I'd probably have to be at Calais rowing my boat very quickly because we've got the quarantine coming up again. No, I wouldn't. I have my mum lives down in Cornwall. My family live all down in that part of the southwest. No, it's changed completely. It's nearly 30 years ago since I left. If anything, I would go back to Amsterdam, but I would not go back to England permanently. No. Yeah. I miss the pub and the idea and the concept of fish and chips, and see my mates for a couple of days when I'm in London, go down the Dog and Duck and a few of the Soho pubs where I used to loiter. But I think after 3-4 days, I'd really be quite happy to land at Toulouse Airport, pick up the car and drive through the landscape back home.
Yeah, I'm with you on that all the way. As a cartoonist, who are your biggest influences?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, Jean-Jacques Sempé. Giles, I grew up with. I think he's great. Matt, I think he does the most fantastic things. Jacques Tati, I think he's brilliant. What other cartoonists? Well, I mean, Searle, I really like. Scarf, Gerald Scarf, I think they were fantastic, and they still are. And they were really cutting, you know. I love their stuff. There are a couple of Dutch ones as well that you won't know, but they're also just throw this line down so quickly, and yet they encapture, you know, that the stance, the expression, and it's just, I just love it. It's so beautifully done in just so few lines. There's a real artist.
I particularly like Giles myself. I've grown up with him.
I love it. You know, the kids, you know, the kids are always up to something. And if you have a look, there was always something happening in a corner that wasn't supposed to be happening, something silly. And that I have to say, I've gotten from him, is that often in my drawings, there will be something happening in the corner, which could, you know, change the situation that you're looking at. So there's the main story or the gag, but I've often got little bits and pieces happening left and right. You know?
Yeah, well, that's the beauty of the cartoons that you do. I love looking at all the bits and the things that are going on in the background. That is the best part of your cartoons, I think. What is your favourite medium for creating cartoons?
The pen, you know, the dip pen I love, because with just weight and a gesture, you can change the weight of that line so quickly. You can go for something really, really a fine line up to something that could be, you know, 2-3 millimetres thick. And I just love that with just a gesture like that, you can bring something to life. If you were working with, say, like a rotary pen or, you know, a biro, it's all one weight. But with a dip pen, you can really create something. And I think it has more movement. It has more life in it. And that, I love it. And yeah, the watercolors was something I wasn't really doing at the beginning, but I was using a walnut stain, which I loved. It gave that rustic feel. But yeah, it's funny. It's what they use for staining wood, which is great because it had this like sepia feel to it. But what I didn't realize was when I was doing it, I had 3 or 4 pots of different intensities, is that unlike watercolor, when you pass over with a second layer, it all starts to bloom again. It doesn't sit tight at all. So I had this like cauliflower of colors coming up. So the walnut stain now sits over there. I don't use so much, but I love the watercolors and dropping in the shadow, which really, I mean, gives the dynamism to everything. I remember Giles, he used to do it with that sort of film. He used to cut out a film, which was, that was all the old style. It was like a half-tone texture that would be laid across. I remember seeing some of his original artworks, which had those films, which were laid over the top of it. But no, I think I love the dip pen. You know, if you're having a bad day, you can see it in the pen. And if I'm working, when we're talking earlier, if I was working for clients and I'm thinking, oh, I've got to get this right, I think that's, it becomes tighter and it becomes less spontaneous, and I can see it in the line, I feel it in the line. And often I'll have to do 3 or 4 of them, throw them away, and then get to the point, okay, forget it, you know what you want to do, and just get on with it. And then it starts coming to life, and you can feel the vibrancy, you can feel the life in the line.
Yeah. Do you ever use graphics tablets at all?
I have, yes, I've had a couple. I've not really gotten on with them, to be honest. And I felt also that the medium, or at least the style, the genre that I'm working with, I prefer to work within the old-fashioned style. Yes, I mean, the light pens, they're great, and you can do the tones. I went to see David Hockney's The Bigger Picture in Bilbao, which is 3 hours from here. Fantastic. And he did so many with the iPads and tablets, and I have a Wacom. And it was great. But, you know, the bigger my screen got, I've worked with, you know, iMac 27-inch, and, you know, you're doing these huge gestures to fill the screen, or you have to exaggerate and enlarge the gesture, and then it suddenly becomes, you know, a little too much. No, I use Photoshop in the end, because I have a high-end camera, a Hasselblad with a digital back, and I shoot that, and I've got a photo studio in what was the pigsty, and which is great, and that shoots stuff, and it puts through into, I have a Kodak Leaf software, and then from there I can convert them into TIFFs and clean it up, and just, you know, little mistakes one makes, or just color balance and stuff like that. So that's what I use technology-wise, at least, but I prefer to work the old-fashioned dip pen.
You've published your fourth book of your cartoon collections. Have you gone through a traditional publisher, or are you an independent publisher controlling everything yourself?
Gone for the second route. I was approached by one publisher that was going to offer me 7%. When I was thinking, you know, a book, €29, by the time everyone's taken their cut, I get something less than €2, which was not brilliant. And I thought, well, I'm a graphic designer. I can put everything together. I can do all the page layout. And I've worked with printers before. So we had a long conversation about it, Caroline and I, and thought, you know what, let's just stick our neck out and try it. Even if it's this first time, if it doesn't work, we can always go back. And so that's what we did. And I found a printer in Italy, because they're well known for their, you know, for the binding and printing. And that worked very well. But eventually I did find a company here that gave me a little bit more option. But, you know, here, it's crazy, the diffusers, or the, you know, distributors here, they take 55%, which is crazy. But, you know, they'll take 55%, so they'll take the books away, they'll put it in storage, and then they'll distribute it to all the bookshops. And the bookshops take maybe 30, 35, 40%. So 15% for them plus 40% for them. So that's 55, plus you've done the printing. They normally pay for the page makeup. Well, the publisher has to make money. And everyone makes money, apart from when you get down to the writer or the author or the creator, you get the smallest slice. And, of course, you're cherry on the cake for a while, even though you've got great distribution. But, of course, they have other authors. And so, you know, after a while, you get lost in the layers and you have to keep fighting to be up there. So we thought, you know what? And we spoke with quite a few bookshops and asked them what their advice was. And they said, well, the ones you could go with, they're all, you know, they're hard-nosed business people and you're just a commodity. They don't really have that feeling of empathy. And I think you should, if you have the guts to go for it, then I suggest, you know, you do your own presentation, your own distribution. And that's what we've done. And I'm in about 60-odd bookstores in Southwest France. I have one in Paris and Bordeaux or Toulouse. I have one in Amsterdam now. And that's great, you know, because people love the personal touch. And I'm doing book signings at the moment, like they're going out of fashion. So when I got my big protective screen, my Perspex screen, a little slot. It's like I'm selling tickets for the cinema, you know. Ticket stalls, please, which is fun. But it means I can communicate people without having a mask over my face and not understand what people are saying. So yeah, publishing ourselves is great. And also we have a website, but also I produce all the flyers, the bookmarks, everything else. And so we control everything.
Have you thought of going on Amazon with a print on demand?
No, I put myself on Amazon at the start because I felt it's, you know, people say, are you on Amazon? And that was like a benchmark, you know, you had to be on Amazon if you're going to be serious. And I turn over, you know, some books, it's not nowhere near as much as I get off my own site and other places. I'm getting a bit political here now, but I feel that they've made enough money in the last 6 months. And if you're not going to repay back into society, then I don't think you should be. I don't think you should be a franchise. So what I'm going to do, I have them there, and I'm taking them. I have two books on there, and I'm taking them off. So I'm going to put them through other sources. As they have a great saying here, je n'achète pas chez Amazon, j'achète dans ma zone. So I don't buy at Amazon, I buy in my zone. Oh. So that means basically buying local.
Yeah.
And so the bookshops have been forced here to be closed for 3.5-4 months. They were in tears, practically. Were people coming up with lists saying, I've been saving up this list. I want you to be here still, which is great. And I'd much rather working with bookstores, the people that really know what they're doing, as opposed to a warehouse man that just pulls it out with a barcode and lobs it in a box. And they, you know, they have the power, obviously, because they're great. And people say, well, I've not received my book yet. Well, I said, it's only 3 days. They say, well, yes, but with Amazon. I say, well, that's Amazon, you know. They own the world. You know, the couriers will bend over backwards to get it to you tomorrow because it's Prime. I don't do Prime either. So I said, we're a mum and pop shop. You know, I'm head artist and head of bubble wrap. you know, that's what we do. We've got our own little business going here. It's going on nicely, and we don't need to be doing other stuff. You know, life is awesome to be enjoying instead of just being, you know, it's all not all about numbers. As I've said before, I'm much richer in my heart, even though I'm not so rich in my pocket.
Yeah, no, I'm with you all the way on that as well.
Yeah.
Looking back over a long and varied career, what would you consider is the best piece of work or project that you've ever created? Or perhaps there's more than one. Well, probably is.
I don't know. Do you know, for me, it's often the one I've just drawn. But there are two or three that I really like. At the moment, I've got one which is of a cockerel sitting on a flying head of garlic through the air. And you have to explain the French, because it's called volaille. Volaille is French for fowl. That's the generic word for fowl. Oh, yeah, that's the one. You've got it in front of you there. And I just love it because he's got this nonchalant look on his face. It reminds me, I don't know if you remember the Heineken commercial with the pigeon that's flying, and he's singing like Dean Martin. And he gets shot by shotgun, and he gets flying down. And on the end, he pulls his parachute and takes Heineken, and then he marries the carry on again, you know. And that was, and he had this nonchalant look, you know, eyes sort of eyelids halfway down, and I just love this look. So volaille means fowl, but also vol means to fly, flying, and eye means garlic. So vol eye is flying garlic, but you've also got this chicken on top, which makes it volaille. It's difficult to explain, but I just love it, and the French just pee their pants when they see it. They just absolutely love it. And you know, it's when I see, having worked for years with account people that say, you know, it needs to be in less time, it needs to be for half the price, and can we change it, and can we make the logo bigger, and can we just change the words? And you know, as we say, you know, a camel is a horse created by committee, and often as not, that's how it is. You know, with the account people, you come away saying, well, you've just castrated, beheaded, you know, and Frankenstein my idea. So it's nice to have people in front of me that just crack up. I've had people in tears, in laughter. I've had people coming up, giving me a kiss and giving me a bottle of Armagnac, saying thank you so much for what you've done, which is crazy. But yes, I think it really depends. And I think very much so, I think I have to look back. My advertising time was great, but in my heart, I'm not materialistic. I work for these great car brands, and I much prefer to drive around in old classic cars, which is what I did. Despite insistence from the client. I think it's what I've done now, because it comes from the heart. It's something I really enjoy doing. There's not a motive behind it. I'm not trying to sell anything. So I think, yes, it's the latest drawing is the one that, yeah, tickles my fancy. I think that's great. And I can look back at the archive of things I've done. So, yeah, that's fun. One I did, which I really love, is called Mammy Wilkinson. You've got Johnny Wilkinson. We all know Johnny. Well, it's a lady, and it's a farmer lady, and she's bending over the way that Johnny does, you know, bending over with the like the praying mantis, like that. And in front of her is this chicken, who's nonchalantly, you know, pecking away at not knowing what's coming. And there's the washing line with the two posts and the washing hanging up. And it's not called Johnny Wilkinson, but Mammy, which is French for grandmother or granny, Mammy Wilkinson. And I put that up, and I had it on a show at this big exhibition, and the president of Toulon Rugby Club came in when Johnny was there, and he died laughing. And I loved all the guys that were all doing the same pose, explaining to the wives why this thing was funny. And I just loved it. And I sent two, I found his address in Newcastle, and sent two to him. And his mum picked it up and said, well, he's commentating at the Rugby World Cup at the moment, but you know, he'll be back, and I'm sure he'll love it. And I said, if he could just sign it, it'd be great, and send one back. Anyway, about 4 weeks later, it turned up, and opened it up, and there was one left. He'd kept one, which is great. And it just said, with great respect and many thanks, Johnny Wilkinson. And that's hanging up now. I'm looking at it now in my studio. So that was a proud moment. I'm glad he liked it.
Oh, that's great. If you had a time machine and could go back to the early days when you first started drawing cartoons, what advice would you give to the young Perry Taylor?
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, follow your heart. Absolutely. I hesitated, and I think we all hesitate, because, you know, the more we know stuff, is people say, well, you know, that drawing only took 40 seconds. Actually, no, it took 30 years. and you have to explain that sort of thing. And that's the confidence that one gets, you know, the gestures that one does. And I think to stand up for myself and not trying to forgive for what you've done, not to give in, because, you know, I was always better. I could create something that no one else could do. You know, I'd have the account guys give me stick, but when the client had a birthday, they come, you know, come around all leaky leaky saying, oh, well, could you just, I love that word, just do, you know, a likeness. This is based on sort of a 4-pixel, you know, passport photograph where they're not looking in the best of moods. And I got to do something for their birthday, you know, and then, you know, all the pressure's back on you. I'm thinking, well, I'm not getting paid for this. I'm not even going to get invited to the bloody party, you know, and I'm going to do this and make my account man look good. So I'm saying those days I should have actually said bugger off and just been more my own man. But, you know, I like to please and I love drawing cartoons and it's what I've always done. And if I can't explain something, I can often just put it down on paper, which helps down here sometimes when you're trying to find a part for something at the shop and you think, I've no idea what this is even in English, you know, and hand it over. There you go. But, yes, I think so. Follow your heart. And, you know, you can make a living out of something which actually is fun. You don't have to be a slave to the system.
So if you jump back into the time machine and went forward 10 years from now, what would you like to have achieved in those 10 years?
Well, the barn finished. Yeah, it's a long story. The builders left yesterday, but I've got a lot of work to do on that. That would be great because that would be my summer studio. I mean, I'm working in what used to be the old wine cave of the house, which is on the north side. It's got these beautiful old stones, which keep it cool. And when we came here, there were half a dozen big wine barrels, which is great. That would be nice. 10 years' time, I don't know. I'm not really one for fame and stuff. I just that I can be doing what I'm doing and just really enjoying it. But also having maybe a few more days off, I think. It'd be nice. I work through the summers. Normally, I do the big jazz festival with Marciac. You know, we have people like Jamie Cullum and Nile Rodgers, and we had Lenny Kravitz and Sting last year. It's huge. And I open up an old barn, which is in that town, for 3 weeks, and it's madness. We had 12,000 people come through our doors in 17 afternoons. It's madness. And at the end, you know, I just need the hammock unplugged from everything for about 10 days. Don't talk to me. Intravenous rosé. That's it. We came down here to smell the flowers and have a better way of life. We've certainly got that. But at the moment, you know, working for ourselves, we're doing easy, you know, 60, 70-hour weeks because we're engaged. We have the website going and lots of other things happening. And I think both of us have this sort of we have ideas. Oh, well, let's try this. Let's try that. And so there's always something moving. We're not static at all. And, of course, I don't know what I'm going to be producing next week. So it's not like I'm just knocking stuff off out at the end of the line and, you know, doing photocopies or whatever. It's what I'm creating is something new. But I think I can feel that there's always a development and I'm learning new things. So, I think just to be able to create even more beautiful things in the future, that'd be great.
You said 60 or 70 hours working a week, but I think in your case, it's not like working.
Do you know, if I get 10% of my time to actually draw, I'm lucky. I mean, this morning I've been doing some photoshopping. I've been putting together posters for book signings I'm doing. I've been corresponding with clients that haven't been able to order stuff on the site. I've been corresponding with a bookshop that wants to take on my book. And what's your commission? I said, you're doing all that sort of stuff. Caroline's doing a lot of that as well. So you've got lots of copy and paste jobs. You know, we've got formula stuff we can send out. And there's also garden, there's chickens. you know, there's also going to the old rugby match and stuff. No, but working, yes, it's a lot of it is, I think, like everything in life, is execution. But I'm always, you know, I've always got pads full of lots of little drawings and sketches and ideas, and I'm seeing something and think, oh, that's great. I think that's my favorite time is sketching stuff down. And then, you know, the execution is another story. And I think from the days when I was taught how to do technical, you know, the exploded perspective views from just plans, I've kept that. And so I can, in my mind's eye, I can create the angle that I think would work best, or that behind here. And what sort of lens would you use? Would it be a wide? Would it be a long? You know, as you would think for your composition. And that's always great. I think you have those tools that kick in automatically, which is great. Yeah, it's a lot of time, but I think what I say is although it's supposedly work, I'm doing what I enjoy.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm often doing research on stuff. I watch films. I've been watching a load of Coen Brothers stuff, which is one of my favorites, you know, Fargo and films like that. And I just love the silliness of it, but also the composition. And I'll often go back and go through Sompé's books and things like that. And there's always around you, there's always inspiration.
Finally, where can the listeners see your work and contact you?
Well, I'm based in Southwest France, and I'm really, unless you're in this area, you're not going to get to face-to-face with me, unfortunately. If you go to my website, I have a website which is a sort of big gallery of all sorts of stuff, which is great. If you're ever feeling depressed and you're looking for a little bit of a light relief, a glass or a cup of something would be rather nice. And it's just my name, perrytaylor.fr. The .com belongs to someone in the States and wants a ridiculous amount of money for it because he's not using it, but still. perrytaylor.fr, that's Taylor as in Elizabeth, and Perry as in Como. perrytaylor.fr. And then there I've got all my books, my prints, and lots of little lots of cards and stuff. But also you can then see the exhibitions that I'm going to be doing. I'm doing book signings here and there all around in Southwest France. I did do the France show occasionally in Olympia, but that was a bit of a schlep, you know, 3 days there. But it was 2 days to get up, 2 days back. And by the time you pay payage, the ferry, the hotel, there was enough for a packet of crisps and a beer on the way back, you know, which is great, you know, to get my name out there. Because, I'm also in the Connection newspaper. Connection is the English-speaking French newspaper, which is comes out monthly, which is great. It gives you all the information that you're catching up. It's compilation of all the news that's happening in France, and it's very relevant to obviously expats in France at this moment.
Perry, thank you very much for appearing on the podcast. It's been really enjoyable listening to your adventure through your cartoony life, and I think you've reached your utopia down there in the south of France. I'm really envious. That's all I can say.
You can come down and help me do the weeding anytime. I was down at 7 o'clock this morning, and I got out there, and I thought before it gets hot, so I was out there pulling all the weeds out and from between the onions and the tomatoes and something. But no, it's great. You know, that's a great one. You can turn off from everything. You're there, and there's a hare that keeps coming by, and you know, all the loads of birds here. I love bird watching, and just nature is just bursting around here. So yes, I suppose we have found a little corner of paradise here.
Before I go, are you a cartoonist or a supplier of artist materials? Perhaps you supply art-related technology or have an art-based business. I am looking for people to share their cartoony world with others on the podcast. If you're interested in being featured, please contact me through the link in the show notes. Okay, that's it for this edition of the podcast. Hope you enjoyed it and catch you on the next one.